This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Earlier today, President Bush, flanked by top national security officials, embraced some of the key recommendations of the 9/11 Commission report. The announcement comes just a day after the government raised the terror threat level in parts of Washington, D.C., New York City, and Newark, New Jersey. In the week and a half since its release, the 9/11 Commission report has become one of the fastest-selling books in history. If you've read the report and thought about what's in it, here's your chance to put your questions to two of its authors. In just a couple of minutes, Commissioners Richard Benveniste and Slade Gorton join us. Our email address is totn@npr.org. The phone number is 800-989-8255. That's 800-989-TALK. First, though, a substantial excerpt from President Bush's remarks today in the White House Rose Garden.
Today I'm asking Congress to create the position of a National Intelligence Director. The person in that office will be appointed by the President with the advice and consent of the Senate and will serve at the pleasure of the President. The National Intelligence Director will serve as the President's principal intelligence advisor and will oversee and coordinate the foreign and domestic activities of the intelligence community. Under this reorganization, the CIA will be managed by a separate director. The National Intelligence Director will assume the broader responsibility of leading the intelligence community across our government. I want and every president must have the best, unbiased, unvarnished assessment of America's intelligence professionals. Creating the position of the National Intelligence Director will require a substantial revision of the 1947 National Security Act. I look forward to working with the members of Congress to move ahead on this important reform. The 9/11 Commission also made several recommendations about Congress itself. I strongly agree with the Commission's recommendation that oversight of intelligence and of the Homeland Security must be restructured and made more effective. There are too many committees with overlapping jurisdiction, which waste time and makes it difficult for meaningful oversight and reform. Today I also announced that we will establish a National Counterterrorism Center. This new center will build on the analytical work, the really good analytical work, of the Terrorist Threat Integration Center, and will become our government's knowledge bank for information about known and suspected terrorists. The new center will coordinate and monitor counterterrorism plans and activities of all government agencies and departments to ensure effective joint action and that our efforts are unified in priority and purpose. The center will also be responsible for preparing the daily terrorism threat report for the President and senior officials. The director of the National Counterterrorism Center will report to the National Intelligence Director once that position is created. Until then, the center will report to the director of the CIA.
President Bush at the White House Rose Garden earlier today. Joining us now are two of the 9/11 commissioners. Richard Benveniste is a former Watergate prosecutor and a partner in the Washington law firm of Mayer, Brown, Rowe, and Maugham. He's with us from the studios of member station KUOW in Seattle. Welcome.
Oh, thank you, Neil.
And Slade Gorton, a former Republican senator from the state of Washington, and he's also with us at KUOW, and it's good to have you as well.
We're happy to be here as a partnership.
Good. Well, let's start with your reaction to the president's remarks this morning. Obviously, there's a lot of details yet to go, but he has at least embraced the idea of a national intelligence director. Your reaction, why don't we begin with you, Senator Gorton?
Well, 11 days after our report was issued, the response has been fast, prompt, and gratifying. Senator Kerry has endorsed our report. Both houses of Congress and both parties have set up hearings on the subject, and now the president has rather explicitly adopted what may be the most important or one of the three most important of the recommendations that we made, that for a national intelligence director. We think that's very, very good. I think the National Counterterrorism Center is equally important. As a matter of fact, the two will work together very well. But if we can now persuade Congress to do what it needs to do to put these things into the law before it quits for the election, we will have had a real triumph.
And Richard Benvenista, the one difference, or at least significant difference, there's a lot of detail left to go, but one significant difference, the 9/11 Commission report recommended putting this NID, National Intelligence Director, inside the White House. The president said outside.
Well, I think there are very good reasons for having it outside. We discussed it. Our recommendations are not set in concrete, and I think they require debate. I'm gratified that the unanimous report of the 9/11 Commission has rekindled a sense of urgency and a sense of unity of purpose. Our five Republicans and five Democrats came together and issued a unanimous report without a single word of dissent. And so I think our recommendations, which are based on a painstaking 20-month inquiry into the facts regarding 9/11 and the reasons why our country failed to prevent that catastrophe, inform our recommendations and have been received, I think, very positively in most quarters. But there are entrenched bureaucracies who will oppose implementation of our recommendations. It won't be easy, and particularly with respect to our recommendations for congressional oversight, which is an absolutely essential part of what we have recommended. That Congress streamline and make more accountable the executive department in terms of oversight over the intelligence community, those reforms need also to be enacted. Our recommendations are interlocking and interdependent, and we're hopeful that we will see both the executive and the Congress act with all deliberate speed to implement them.
I want to second what Richard said. The one thing we have not heard yet from Congress is specific proposals to improve and to consolidate congressional oversight itself. And for the Congress, that'll probably be the most difficult job because it means a lot of people will lose authority they have at the present time.
Mm-hmm. We want to give listeners as much of an opportunity to ask questions as possible. 800-989-8255 is the phone number. That's 800-989-TALK. Email TOTN at NPR.org. Let's begin with Les in Boise, Idaho.
Morning, Neil. First-time caller to the show. As a student of history and political science, I have a question for your guest. I understand that this position has been attempted twice in the past, once with the Director of Central Intelligence, and then I believe with the creation of the National Security Council. I'm just wondering what is going to make this position different in respect to the bureaucracy, the infighting, and the jealous protection of the turf and, more importantly, the budgets of the agencies. And I'll take my answer and comment off the air. Thank you.
Thanks very much.
Okay. There is a real difference between what we have proposed and the two examples that the caller suggested. The first is way back in 1947 when the CIA director, the CIA was created. The CIA director was given statutorily oversight over all of our intelligence activities. But because that director controls only 20% of the money, the other 80% being in the Defense Department, no CIA director has ever really exercised that power. Very few have even tried to exercise it. And you can't have one person, CIA director, principal advisor to the president, and running the entire intelligence operation of the United States. You really have to separate that. Being CIA director, a director, is a full job on its own. And the National Security Council should be dealing with policies, not with implementation, not with day-to-day activities.
I agree completely with what Slade has said. The ability to break down the stovepipes of 15 different intelligence agencies can only be accomplished, in our view, by having this National Intelligence Director have budgetary authority over the intelligence community. That authority now rests 80% in the Pentagon. And that is an essential part of our recommendation. The NSC has proved ineffective, quite frankly, in being able to knock heads together and get the agencies to cooperate in sharing intelligence. If we had to give them a grade on the old report card system that I was used to, they'd get an F for works and plays well with others. This new intelligence director has got to do better and will be able to do better by coordinating if our recommendation for providing the NID with budget authority is enacted.
Let's go now to Raymond, who joins us from Menlo Park, California.
Hi, I'm an active duty Army officer, and I noticed with interest the comparisons the panel made to the Goldwater-Nichols reforms of the late 80s. It seems to me one of the reasons, one of the main reasons Goldwater-Nichols worked was that Congress mandated that military officers had to have joint jobs in order to advance. And so I'd like to hear the panel's thoughts about what similar types of jobs would be created within the intelligence community to forward this, and how you could really, how Congress could enforce that type of joint attitude.
And
I can answer off the air.
Thanks, Raymond. And I should just insert that Goldwater-Nichols created the Joint Chiefs of Staff as we currently know them, and created the chairman of the Joint Chiefs as the president's principal military advisor. And in his remarks today, the president was asked if either the Federal Reserve Board or the Joint Chiefs of Staff would be a model, and he said, not the Fed, more the Joint Chiefs of Staff. With that, Richard Benveniste, do you want to take that?
Well, we looked at Goldwater-Nichols, and that provides us with an excellent model. We feel that the coordination of the intelligence services was one of the major failings leading up to 9/11, and by providing one quarterback, who will be this National Intelligence Director, that person will be able to allocate responsibilities and provide the necessary synthesis, both in tasking and analysis, for the intelligence community, and then will report to the president.
The parallels aren't absolutely precise, but they're pretty close. Let's take the National Counterterrorism Center, for example. It will undoubtedly have people assigned to it from the CIA and from the FBI and from other intelligence organizations. One of the reasons, to give you a second look at it, that we more or less approved the reforms that the FBI has undertaken during the course of the last 3 years was that under Director Mueller, every new arrival at the FBI will take the same basic training. Every one of them will have to have an initial assignment both on the intelligence side and the law enforcement side. And the career tracks will be as attractive to both of them. And at least the assistant agent in charge in each of the offices of the FBI must have a very, very strong intelligence background. So the kind of joint assignments the caller speaks about in the military will have a parallel in the new system.
Our guests this hour are Slade Gorton, a former Republican senator from the state of Washington, and Richard Benveniste, a former Watergate prosecutor. Both of them are now best-selling authors, I guess. They're two of the 9/11 commissioners. When we come back from a short break, we'll take more of your calls and emails about what's in the commission's report, what isn't in it, and what questions you have about its implementation. Our number is 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, or you can email us, TOTN@NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We're talking today with two of the 9/11 commissioners and taking your calls. What questions you have about the report, where should we go from here? 800-989-8255. Email TOTN@NPR.org. This from Joe Haney in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Like many persons of both parties, I'm very concerned that with national intelligence being directed by one person speaking with one voice to the president, alternative and minority findings on intelligence will not be seen, considered, or reported. Streamlining means essentially stripping away what someone thinks is superfluous for the sake of expediency. Isn't there some less monolithic coordinating structure that could be created short of this proposed concentration of power?
We've had a decentralized system literally for 50 or 60 years, and it's failed rather spectacularly at the time of 9/11. We do say in our report that perhaps the greatest single failure leading up to 9/11 was a failure in imagination, and we haven't figured out a way to pass a law mandating imagination, but we do want a structure in which imaginative answers can at least get to the top, get up to this National Intelligence Directorate, which they haven't in the past. And we believe that we will have at least as great a chance and perhaps a greater chance for more than one idea to get up to that National Intelligence Director from 15 different agencies when they're all going one place than when when many of them were just lost and never got out of their own departments.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think Mr. Haney's question is a good one. Heretofore, however, that information was provided by one of the 15 agencies, the CIA, to the president, and perhaps there was a bias within that agency having the ear of the president on a daily basis. Now, here, the National Intelligence Director will not have a dog in the fight in the competition between and among the agencies. Alternatives and differing viewpoints, I think, will be a function of the president's activism in soliciting alternative views and viewpoints that come up to the National Intelligence Director. So it should be an interactive process, and the president should be in a position for asking the right questions of his NID.
Let's get another caller in. James from Charlotte, North Carolina.
Hi, Neil. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I've read about two-thirds of the way through the report. It's fascinating. And I had a question regarding the use of military. And I think a military response to terrorism is warranted, and I support that. But when the president went before the joint houses joint session of Congress, he announced there was no difference between the terrorists and the states that sponsor them. And in reading the report, there were numerous examples of Iran either directly and indirectly financing, funding, and aiding and abetting various terrorist groups, including Al-Qaeda. So my question is, if we're going to use the military, why was Iran not the first priority versus Iraq? They have an active nuclear program, and their support of terrorism is well known and documented. And I'd like to hear some active discussion on that. I'll take my call off the air.
Thanks, James.
That's beyond our pay grade. Now, what we were charged to do essentially was two things. One was to write an objective history of the relevant facts that led up to 9/11. And the second was to come up with recommendations as to how our intelligence and anti-terrorism activities could be better managed in the future. The actual policy decisions that are going to be made as to what has the number one priority and what the number two is essentially a function of the President of the United States, and we can't anticipate a specific challenge in the future. We just want to see to it that the President has all the all of the relevant information and is able to make those decisions on the basis of all that relevant administration. I think we found that both presidents were frustrated by the quality of the intelligence they got for many years.
And we should not leave out Congress's role in evaluating and advising under our recommendations in their oversight capacity on issues such as the wisdom of using our forces to preemptively attack. And so the issue of Iran and Iraq are those which specifically we do not address, but we leave to the American public the job of evaluating the information we've provided in order to draw their own conclusions about the wisdom of various executive action.
What can you, though, tell us about a story that I guess initially appeared in Newsweek magazine, and we learned more about it this weekend in the Washington Post, by Dana Priest, an al-Qaeda commander who initially told interrogators Iraq had provided chemical and biological weapons training to the terrorist organization, later told CIA officers his statement was not true. According to intelligence officials, Ibn al-Sheikh al-Libi, a Libyan captured in Pakistan November 11, 2001, later changed his story. We're still in the process of trying to determine what's right and what's not right from his information. He told us one thing at one time, another at another time. Al-Libi's statement formed the basis for the Bush administration's pre-war claim that Osama bin Laden collaborated with Iraq. Do you gentlemen know anything about Mr. Al-Libi?
Well, we heard the same information, of course, and it's reflected in our report that individual, Mr. Al-Libi, had recanted previous information suggesting a collaborative relationship in those areas. We are clear in our conclusion that there is no credible evidence to suggest any collaborative relationship between al-Qaeda and Saddam Hussein or the government of Iraq in connection with any activity against the United States. That's not to say that they didn't, over the years, make overtures toward one another. It's sort of like a high school dance. They might have looked at each other with the a glint of romance in their eyes, but at various times, those overtures were not accepted by the other party. And so, to the best of our ability, we concluded, after looking at all of the evidence, that there was no such collaborative relationship between Iraq and al-Qaeda.
One of the difficult problems we faced, of course, is that a great amount of this information, as you will read when you look at the end notes, comes from terrorists who have been captured and interrogated since. No one can rely 100% on any statement that any one of them makes. What we've done is to examine all of those statements to the best of our ability to do so, and the best of the ability of a magnificent staff of 80 people, I may say, to do so as well, and have come up with the conclusions we think are most reasonable.
Let's get another caller in. Daniel's with us from Asheville, North Carolina.
Hello, good afternoon. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My question is to do with the original information that the White House put out when 9/11 first happened. There was considerable information about Saudi involvement, which we were not allowed to hear anything about. And there was quite a hoo-ha at the time that this information was restricted. I'm wondering whether the 9/11 Commission itself had any further information about Saudi involvement, because it seems to me it'd be well in their interest to have Iraq, their closest neighbor and threat, neutralized. My first question, quick second one, do you think that this new director of intelligence should be appointed by the president? Isn't this possibly open, this person open to being biased? And don't you think he should be appointed by some senior members of Congress so that we are ensured of getting someone that will look after the country's best interest as opposed to particular political bias at any time?
Well, as a former member of Congress, I'm not at all sure that that kind of an appointment is going to be any freer of bias. But no. The reason that you have a person like this appointed by the president is that it's the president he's advising, and the president who's making most of the policy decisions on the basis of that advice. And you certainly risk, as you always do, fudging advice or even fudging intelligence in the direction of what someone wants to hear. But by the same token, the president has got to have confidence in this individual in order to act on whatever that individual may say. I'm sorry, the first part of the question?
On the other hand,
Saudi connection. Go ahead, Richard.
Oh, yeah.
On the other hand, the National Intelligence Director should receive the consideration of Congress in the Senate's duty.
Yes.
Of providing advice and consent. So it's not that the Congress is out of the picture. Very definitely the appointment will receive suitable and I would suggest intense scrutiny by the United States Senate.
When the Congress investigated 9/11, in the predecessor study to our own at the end, toward the end of 2002. Its initial report was very substantially censored and redacted, and then I think about a year ago was declassified except for materials with respect to Saudi Arabia. But we have written in this report everything we have learned about Saudi Arabia. The sections on Saudi Arabia, the sections on Saudis, the section on their charities and their participation is all of the result of the work that we've put in on it. And everything we know, you know now.
Well, the Saudis have become a lot more motivated in terms of assisting our intelligence, military, and diplomatic efforts. Their efforts previously, which were not insubstantial, were always tempered by self-interest. They clearly were not as motivated until they were attacked themselves and recognized that al-Qaeda is determined to try to overthrow their regime. And we look at the Saudi relationship and we make certain recommendations in terms of our government's relation with Saudi Arabia, recognizing that the export of a certain brand of Muslim belief that has been supported by the government of Saudi Arabia ought to be toned down. It does not comport with our ideas of inclusiveness, but is rather traditionally been focused on hatred of those who do not believe in an identical way with their own beliefs. So we have a number of recommendations that go beyond the military and other oil-based relationships with Saudi Arabia, which would, in our view, improve the situation considerably.
Thank you, Daniel.
Quick follow-up, please.
If you keep it quick, sure.
Yeah, really quick. You say that the president must have confidence in his new director of intelligence. I think the point for the country is it's much more important that the country has confidence in the president. He also had information that Iraq was fully behind weapons of mass destruction and threatening to shoot one off at our allies or ourselves, and it's proved to be absolutely false. So, I mean, you know, this is a really tricky situation. We've got a man who manipulates the information for his own deal.
Well, there was faulty intelligence, evidently, in that connection, but it comes down to the fact, of course, you have to have confidence in your president. That's what we have elections for.
Thank you, Daniel.
Yeah.
We're speaking with Slade Gordon, a former U.S. senator from the state of Washington, and with Richard Benveniste, former Watergate prosecutor, both members of the 9/11 Commission. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And in that regard, here's an email question from Doug Wyken. I think I got that right. In Winter, South Dakota, the 9/11 Commission was unwilling or unable to find anybody to blame with any specificity for the intelligence and management failures. This kind of generic blame does not impact individuals. Why would rearranging the deck chairs of the intelligence Titanic make any difference in the future?
Well, I'm not sure that I don't know that the two parts of that comment fit together totally. What we did is what we were charged to do, and that was to write a history of what led up to 9/11, and to do that as objectively as possible, and to lay out all those facts. Opinions resulting from those facts and the blame game resulting of those facts is for the people of the United States in reading it. We were able to be unanimous because we were objective and not subjective. That's fundamentally the reason that we did it in the fashion in which you read it at the present time.
Well, we had a series of open hearings. Our objective was to get the facts and let the facts do the talking rather than have us interpret the facts. And as a result of those open hearings, the public was able to see the level of responsibility of the individuals who were charged with safeguarding us and all the way up to the President of the United States and in both administrations. And those open, transparent, public hearings looked at together with a very detailed report, which we have now issued, I think asserts the kinds of facts upon which individuals who are informed by reading the report can draw their own conclusions.
Email question from Jose Rodriguez. I'm curious as to why the 9/11 Commission report was written in a style more akin to a novel than to a dry government report. Was it to gain more readership of an extremely important issue in our country? If so, it was a brilliant move. Please comment.
The answer is yes. I think we can tell you, one minor secret in that connection. When we saw the first draft, what is now Chapter 2 was Chapter 1. In other words, it proceeded entirely chronologically. And what is now Chapter 1 appeared rather close to the end. And unanimously, we decided that the drama of telling the story of the morning of 9/11 itself was so important that it ought to come first. And so it was put first, and then we begin to look back and work forward again. But we're gratified at how many hundreds of thousands of the book have been sold. We'll be more gratified when we feel that all of them have been read.
Well, I'm prepared to accept brilliant.
Well,
in addition to the book sales, the report is available for free on the 9/11 website. www.911.gov, we understand there have been some 3 million downloads of the report from that free website. So we're gratified at that. We did attempt to make our report readable. There are plenty of excellent reports gathering dust in various archives in Washington, D.C. It was our objective in having open hearings and bringing the public along with us, releasing as much information as we possibly could. In fact, getting certain otherwise classified information declassified, and then providing a final report that is readable to allow the American public as much access to the information we had in as readable as form as we could make it.
Richard Benveniste, 9/11 Commissioner, also with us, Slade Gorton, 9/11 Commissioner. More with them, your calls and emails after a short break, 800-989-8255, TOTN at NPR.org. I'm Neil Conan. It's Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. Today, we're discussing the findings of the 9/11 Commission. If you've read the report and have questions about it, here's your chance. 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, email TOTN at NPR.org. Our guests are Slade Gorton, a 9/11 Commissioner, and Richard Benveniste, a 9/11 Commissioner. And let's get right back to the phones. Wayne joins us from Green Bay, Wisconsin.
Good afternoon, gentlemen.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
My main question is this. Recently as last week, 50 Arab nationals were caught crossing the Mexican border into Texas. They were subsequently released. But my question is, until and unless we assume the multi-billion-dollar task of securing our borders, doesn't the reorganization of government at the top stand pretty moot? I mean, these people can come. There's 160,000 people crossing our border every week. We don't know who any of these people are. Your top recommendation to secure the borders.
One of the fascinating parts of the 9/11 story is that none of the 19 hijackers came in, across a border without any documentation at all. They all came through our immigration services. They all had passports. They all had visas. All of them had something wrong with them that, if we had been more careful and looked at them more carefully, might have interrupted that travel. But the answer to your question is, if you read the report, there is a very long section on border security. We agree with you. We think border security is vitally important. We've made recommendations both to the President and Congress with respect to changing our border security policies. And in fact, it's only there that there's any significant cost involved. You know, the reorganization sections we've been discussing so far don't require additional people or much additional money. Border security does.
I agree completely with Slade. We talk about having biometrics added to passports. We talk about standardization of among the 50 states of proof of identification, such as driver's licenses. And we very much agree that the cost of transnational terrorism is that we have got to have a better border security. We wish it weren't so, but one of our top four recommendations is a number of improvements in our border security.
Wayne, thank you.
Thank you.
Why, writes Ronald Cron of Indianola, Iowa, why are the resources of local, state, and state law enforcement totally ignored in the report? How will local intelligence reach other cities and states?
One of the things that we focused on, particularly in terms of making our recommendations about the FBI and how it's operated over the years, is that there was an unnecessary and burdensome level of secrecy imposed. For years and years, the FBI was known as a one-way street, where they received information but were unwilling to share information, not only with state and local, but with other federal agencies. We have attempted, to the best of our ability, to try to take a sledgehammer to those stovepipes, and particularly with respect to the FBI, to ensure that changes are institutionalized which will promote the sharing of intelligence. Our state and local authorities throughout the United States represent a great force multiplier in assisting us in our ability to be a safer country. In order to utilize state and local authorities to the optimum advantage, there must be a greater sharing of information by the federal authorities in a way that is appropriate. Obviously, we're not going to recommend, nor should the agencies be divulging sources and methods, but information is critical, and it should be disclosed to those agencies which are best able to utilize it.
Last week here in Seattle, I was invited by the mayor and the chief of police and the fire department chief to speak with them about my experiences on 9/11. I was very favorably impressed with the work they had done to coordinate their own activities. You may notice that coordination between the fire departments and the police departments in New York left something to be desired on 9/11. Here and elsewhere, there's a lot of work has been done on that. And in Seattle, the local work has been done in a magnificent fashion. They are also members of a joint terrorism task forces here that involves the federal agencies. The mayor did say that they still weren't getting all of the information that they thought they ought to get from the FBI. Things are better, but they're not good enough. And one of the recommendations that we make, as much as we like the reforms in the FBI, is that they be institutionalized. They be put into law or put into an executive order so it can't relapse back into its old ways when it gets another new director.
Email question from Nathan Graber in Elkhart, Indiana. Is there part of the commission's report that deals with the root causes of terrorism? For example, is anyone asking what changes in policy we could make that would reduce the number of our enemies? Our Middle East policy, the war in Iraq, our relations with Saudi Arabia, all these are actions that have made more enemies for the U.S., which means they increase terrorism. Does the commission address this?
Yes, we do. We have a section that is devoted to that very issue. We talk about, for example, adhering in this country and getting our allies to promulgate and adhere to uniform standards with respect to treatment of those who are captured. and providing a level of protection on some international standard. Beyond that, we talk about education and promoting an educational fund directed toward areas of the world in which we see the greatest danger. We have recognized that in the Middle East, we are down to the single digits in terms of approval of United States actions. And we must do a lot more than showing our military might to people throughout the world to understand the positive attributes of our society. And we must win the war of ideas by clearly setting forth what the United States is about and coming back to the point where we become the gold standard for what other societies want to be. We don't want to make them all into our image. That would be foolish. But we want to at least communicate our ideals and standards and what this country is all about, because there is a skewed view of the United States through too much of the world.
We take we try to create a balance on that. There are sections in the report on three specific countries, Pakistan, Afghanistan, and Saudi Arabia. But at the same time, you need to read what Osama bin Laden stands for and what they want. When he was asked what it would take to stop his attacks, he said it was very simple. Abandon the Middle East, convert to Islam, end the immorality and godlessness of our society and culture. And then a direct quote, it is saddening to tell you that you are the worst civilization witnessed by the history of mankind. End quote. There's not much room for compromise there. So we have to do both things. We have to go after that minority, but a substantial minority who are simply out to kill us. And we also have to do far better in showing what we really are and in supporting a life-affirming philosophy rather than a death-affirming society.
9/11 Commissioners Slade Gorton and Richard Benveniste, you're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. And let's go now to Nate, who's with us from Newport News, Virginia.
Oh, yes. How do you do? Thank you for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
My biggest worry about this has to do with the politicization of, if that's even a word, intelligence. If we've got one guy who is cabinet level and therefore appointed by somebody who was elected, then we've got one guy whose job is to interpret the truth and who has been appointed by somebody who was elected through political means. And I think we've already gotten ourselves into one big ugly war due to political misinterpretation of actual fact.
No, we've got one guy who is in charge of gathering all of the information that 15 different agencies across our government gather and presenting that information to the president.
Sure,
we don't
sure.
think the National Intelligence Director should be a policy person. You know, now we have one guy, the head of CIA, who's appointed by the president and who makes that statement that he's not a policymaker, but that he just gives factual advice. The president has a National Security Council, which is supposed to provide him with policy advice and to make that policy himself. But in a free country, you elect leaders to make decisions, and those are decisions that you can't avoid. They're going to be made by a president, and the president is elected and ought to be.
Well, that's a good
point.
Nate,
you make a good point, and your concerns are valid concerns. However, someone has to appoint this individual. We clearly need someone to be the quarterback on intelligence, to ensure that intelligence is shared, that it is synthesized and assimilated and directed in a way that is efficient and in the interest of our country. Now, the idea of politicizing intelligence is certainly one that concerns us. The increased role that we see for the United States Congress in its oversight requirement and function is designed toward keeping an eye in a much more focused way than in the past on exactly that issue. So that's our prescription. We hope it is an improvement over the present situation.
Nate, thanks very much.
You're welcome.
I appreciate the phone call. And I wanted to thank both of our guests. You're as I understand it, off on doing this double act in other places.
Yes, we are. We're going to be together in Los Angeles on Friday to testify before the House Homeland Security Committee on these various bills and directions. And we're very gratified that both the Senate and the House are taking this seriously enough so that they're going to try, I think, to have bills to be considered in September.
And thanks. We'll be up in the Bay Area as well, in San Francisco, in the week following, making some speeches and appearances. And we're hopeful that the bipartisan spirit of our commission will catch on again and bring our country's leaders together and focused, as I think they are beginning to, on this very important issue.
Richard Benveniste, Slade Gorton, thanks both very much.
Thank you.
Thank you.